laughing at people who had to believe in God. Many times we've gone by the church house on Sunday morning, we see them walking up the steps, and we say, look at those weak suckers going in there. If they were like we were, they wouldn't have to go in there and be kneeling and praying. I can almost see Bill saying they still aren't going to like this idea of having to have a vital spiritual experience in order to overcome the problem. And he said, maybe I better explain to them some more about alcoholism. And he said, maybe I better show them the exact problem. And you know, step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And many of us in the beginning said, well, we didn't have any trouble with that because of all those crazy, stupid, insane things that we did whenever we were drunk. But we really don't think that's the sanity or insanity that step two is referring to. You know, the crazy, insane, stupid things that we do when we're drinking, not necessarily caused by insanity, that's caused by a mind which has been sedated with a drug called alcohol. And that sedative drug hits the mind and it lowers the inhibition. And then we can do a lot of things that we normally wouldn't do if we were sober. It lowers the ability to make the right decisions. And we do some crazy things. But that isn't caused by sanity or insanity. That's caused by a mind filled with this sedative drug called alcohol. If you really look at the word sanity, the dictionary defines it as the inability to see the truth, or the ability to see the truth, whichever it might be. If you're sane, you can see the truth. If you're insane, you cannot see the truth. And I think it's time to recognize that we can be sane about a lot of things and see the truth about a lot of things, but then insane just about one or two things and not be able to see the truth about one or two items. Insanity doesn't mean that you're all gone. It simply means you're not all here. For instance, if we would take a piece of pie and cut it into 10 pieces, and if we remove one piece of the pie, well, 90% of the pie is still there, but 10%'s gone. The pie is just less than whole. If we took four pieces of pie away, well, 60% of it's still there. Certainly it's not all gone, it's just 40% less than whole. You don't really begin to get into the crazy side until you go below 50-50. Now, many of we alcoholics seem to have been able to display normal, rational thinking in most of our lives. We were able to work. Many of us could make a living. Many of us could take care of a family. Many of us could do most things that normal people do. But when it came to alcohol, we seemed to be unable to see the truth about that. And we seemed to be unable to make rational decisions. Now, Joe and I know a fellow that's locked up in the state insane asylum in Benton, Arkansas. And this little fellow believes that he's a cowboy. He wears a little holster and a toy pistol. And he runs around from time to time pulling that pistol out, shooting people with it. Now, he really thinks he's a cowboy. But the truth is, he's not a cowboy. He ain't got no boots or horse. And he don't even have any manure on his shoes. But you see, he thinks he's a cowboy. Now, he's locked up because he's insane, simply because he cannot see the truth. And we start talking about sanity and insanity in this chapter. We'll be talking about the inability to see the truth. And if we can't see the truth, then we cannot make rational decisions. We're not talking about crazy, just the inability to see the truth. Let's look on page 30, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. And Bill has used three words in those two paragraphs to explain the same situation. He used the word obsession, the word illusion, and the word delusion. And again, if we go look these things up, we would find that they all mean the same thing, to believe a lie. An obsession of the mind is nothing more than an idea that overcomes all ideas. All my life, people told me that I couldn't drink. My mother could see that when I was 14, 15 years old. And she said, son, if you continue to drink alcohol, you're going to end up just like your uncle did in California. You're going to be a wet brain in a nut house, and that's where you'll die. And she could see that, but I couldn't. Alcohol had become such a part of my life already and was such an answer to my problems that my mind had already become obsessed with the idea of using it. And the thing I got from alcohol was so great that it would not let me see the actual truth. My dad said, boy, you can't drink. He said, everybody in the Parmley family that tries to drink end up having trouble with alcohol. He said, we can't drink. And he said, you'll kill yourself by drinking. But I couldn't see that. My first wife could see that I couldn't drink. My boss could see that I couldn't drink. The police could see that I couldn't drink. The neighbors could see it, and my children could see it, and everybody could see it, but I couldn't see it because my mind had become obsessed with the idea that sooner or later I'm going to be able to drink without getting in trouble. And that obsession was so strong that every once in a while I fell for the illusion, for the lie, that I could drink. You know, a magician is called an illusionist. An illusionist is so great with his hands that he can stand in front of you and actually make you believe a lie. And my obsession to drink alcohol was so strong that it created the illusion for me that this time it'll be all right. I would delude myself into the idea of thinking that I could drink. And it really doesn't make any difference what word we use to describe it. Bill used three different words to describe the same situation. The insanity of alcoholism. And as we go through this chapter, we're going to look at some examples. And each example will be to let us see the state of the mind immediately preceding the taking of the first drink. The fact that we can elude ourselves or delude ourselves into the idea that this time it's going to be okay. And you got to always remember that just before taking the first drink, we're stone cold sober. There's no alcohol in our mind before the taking of the first drink. Let's look at the state of the mind preceding the first drink. Page 34, middle of the page. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. The baffling feature is not the allergy. The baffling feature is the inability to leave it alone, no matter how badly we want to. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time, referring to a little example back before this, will be helpful. But we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obviously, this is the crux of the problem. The allergy can't make you get drunk if you don't take the first drink. And the mental state preceding the relapse is the crux of the problem. The body cannot drink unless the mind gives it permission to do that. Joe?
What sort of thing dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who had reasoned with him after his spree, which brought him to the point of divorce and bankruptcy, are mystified of when he walks in directly into a saloon. Why does he, or what is he thinking? And as Charlie has brought out the point, we're talking about the state of the mind preceding the first drink. And we say insanity is believing a lie. And we've always said the truth, the Wesley was talking about the other night. We none of us know the truth. But we say the truth will set you free from the lie. And we say hell is the truth seen too late. Now, before I took a drink, and I remember how I did it now, I didn't understand it. But when I walked into a liquor store, after being sober for a period of time, I would walk right into a liquor store. When I walked into that liquor store, I believed I could drink. And what we're going to show in these stories is bringing out when an alcoholic believes he can drink, that's insanity.
He can't see the truth.
So the truth is that an alcoholic can't drink, but he believes he can. I know, and I have been restored to sanity because the last 23 years, I have never walked in a liquor store and said, "Hey, mister, let me buy another bottle of that stuff that damn near killed me 23 years ago." You really can't do that. Okay, now, he's going to use some examples. And these are, again, using parables to describe this point. And they're entertaining, all of them telling the same story. They don't bore you because they're different and different looks at the same thing. But he's talking about the state of the mind preceding the first drink. Our first example is a friend called Jim. And Charlie and I have a little trouble with Jim. I'll try not to do that tonight. But I just love Jim. He's my kind of guy. I just identify with Jim. This man had a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable world record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. And back then, though, they didn't have treatment centers. They put him in a nut house. Asylum, that's what he treated him in.
Today, we got treatment centers, so we're going to change the word asylum to treatment centers from now on as we go through the
book.
Okay.
We told him what we knew of alcoholism. Okay, now, if we will study that, if they told him what they knew of alcoholism, they must told him the doctor's opinion or whatever they knew about it at that time. The message they got from Dr. Silkworth, which at that time was the first step. And the answer we had found, the answer must have been a power greater than ourselves, so they told him the second step. He made a beginning, and after the third step, we say that it says that step three is a beginning. So it looks like this man took steps one, two, and three. His family was very similar. He began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life. And we're going to learn as we go through the steps, the only way to enlarge on the first three steps is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the rest of the steps. But he obviously stopped. He didn't work anymore. He got busy making money and doing other things. To his consternation, he found himself drunk a half dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic in a serious condition, step one. He knew he faced another trip to the treatment center if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. I remember every time, you know, Jim got drunk, they went over and tried to work with him. They did it again, again, again. And finally, you know, they said, hey, wait a minute, Jim. How did this happen? Tell us, this is going on now too much. Now, just sit down and analyze this, Jim. What's going on?
Remember, sanity is the ability to see the truth and make a rational decision. Insanity is the inability to see the truth and the inability to make rational decisions. Let's look at it progress now in Jim.
And this is what Jim said. Now, this is how it happened. I came to work on Tuesday morning. Now, Charlie and I were just, we've been reading this for years, and this last week we were just astonished when we read this. Where was you on Monday?
Twelve years we've been reading this down.
Okay. I don't know why he said Tuesday. I remember I felt irritated. I had to be a salesman for the concern I once owned.
That's kind of normal.
That's kind of normal.
You're working for a place that you once owned. You've lost it through drinking. Well, you're probably going to feel a little irritated about that. That's kind of normal thinking.
I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
Nothing wrong with that. You know, that happens from time to time, especially if you're working for the place that you once owned.
Okay. Then I decided to drive in the country to see one of my prospects for the car.
Same thinking.
All this guy wanted to do was sell an automobile. What's wrong with that? That's what a salesman's supposed to do. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they had a bar.
Same thinking so far.
I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich.
Same thinking. He's going in there now to get a sandwich. You're not going in there to drink at all.
He didn't go in there to go to the nut house. You know,
he went there to get a sandwich and sell a car. That's right.
I had a notion I might find a customer for the car in this place. So he could get a sandwich and sell a car. Which I had been going there for years, and I had eaten there during the months I was sober. See, he had been eating there.
Same thinking, nothing wrong with this.
I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk.
Same thinking, nothing wrong with a sandwich and a glass of milk when you're hungry.
That's right. Still no thought of drinking.
Same thinking.
I ordered another sandwich.
Same thinking.
And decided to have another glass of milk.
Same thinking. Squiggly right.
Now. Now, here it is. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. If I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered the whiskey and poured it into my milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt assured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. Now, for a man who had just lost his business from drinking, from alcohol, and had been into asylum, for him to think that he could put an ounce of whiskey in his glass of milk, that is insanity.
See, insanity is the inability to see the truth, thereby leading you to a state of mind where you cannot make a rational decision.
Okay. Now, once the alcohol hit his system, then the craving took over. The experiment went so well, I ordered another whiskey and poured it in my milk. It didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Thus charted one more journey to the treatment center for Jim.
There was threat of commitment, the loss of family position, say nothing of the sense of mental and physical suffering which always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, step one, yet all reasons for not drinking were pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How could such a lack of a portion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? And right within this sentence, we can see what is insanity. Insanity is a lack of a portion of the ability to think straight. That is insanity. And when it comes to alcohol, the alcoholic at certain given times doesn't have the ability to think straight about alcohol.
You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnest and sincerity, in some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. Now, many times we say, well, hell, I might as well be drunk because I couldn't feel any worse than I'm feeling now. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we begin to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was very little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. And I love this story. Now, I don't know what this guy gets out of jaywalking, but apparently he gets something I don't get. The book says he gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. That scares the hell out of me. But he gets a thrill out of it. Jumping out in front of these vehicles and see how close they can come to him without hitting him gives him some form of strange satisfaction. Now, he enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. People see him doing this and they say, hey, Jack, you better stop that. You're going to get run over. You're going to get hurt if you don't. But he doesn't, and he enjoys himself in spite of these warnings. Now, up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Now, luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. Now, he's probably getting a little older, and he can't move quite as fast, and they begin to hit him once in a while. Not hurting him bad yet, but hitting him once in a while. Now, you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. But he doesn't. He's not normal. Presently, he's hit again, this time has a fractured skull. Put him in the hospital. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. And he begins to realize he's got a problem because he tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. He sings his national anthem, I ain't never going to jaywalk again as long as I live. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. And on through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. You know, he's telling everybody, don't worry, I'm going to be careful. Hell, I'm not even going to get out there where they are. But finally, he can no longer work. He just gets so beat up, and he's in the hospital so much that they have to fire him. His wife gets a divorce. I'm sure she said, I'm tired of supporting me and the kids and paying your hospital bill, and you're not contributing anything to the family at all. And she divorces him, and he's held up to ridicule by everybody. And he tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Not his body, out of his head. He shuts himself up in a treatment center hoping to mend his way. Now, we laugh about treatment centers. Don't be offended, because we believe in them. Joe runs one, and I've been associated with one for years. But today, they are treatment. We don't call them asylums anymore. He shuts himself in a treatment center hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine which breaks his back. Well, such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? You may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? We may display enormous amounts of intelligence in other areas of our life. And we may be absolutely normal and sane in 90% of our life. But when it comes to alcohol, we seem to have a strange form of insanity. The inability to see the truth about what alcohol is going to do to us. And from time to time, our mind says, well, you know, it's okay to drink. Now, some of you are thinking, well, what you tell us is truth, but it doesn't fully apply. Now, we admit we have some of these symptoms. Well, we've not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We've not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. Now, that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people, who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate, because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers that has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. We want to look at one more. We want to look at Fred. We're going to see that in Fred's case, it's a little different than Jim. Jim didn't feel too good when he drank. You know, he was a little irritated with the boss. He was a little depressed, and he wasn't feeling too great before he took his drink. But we're going to see in Fred's story a guy drinking from the other end of the scale. Now, we tend to think that we have to feel bad in order to take that drink. But we're going to see in Fred's story that we can drink when we're feeling right on top of the world, too. You know, I believe that sometimes we drink to feel better when we feel bad. But I think also sometimes we drink to feel better even when we feel good. On one hand is to raise us up, and the other one is to make us feel better yet, to celebrate with. Let's see what happened to Fred here.
Okay, now Fred, neither, you know, Fred also, Jim had lost what he had. John, now Fred hadn't lost this either. Fred still had most of his life. Fred is a part of a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, a happy marriage, and a father of promising children of college age. He is so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. From there was a successful man is Fred. To all appearance, he's a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic. Now, he wouldn't take step one. He told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor emulated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. He would not accept step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
If you don't take step one, you don't need step two.
Right. He couldn't take step one and two. Remember, Jim took three, but this guy couldn't take either one. One day we were told he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, to exhibit splendid judgment and determination in all other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, and I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on going. This frame of mind, I went about my business for a time, and all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard a work out of a simple matter.
We can see the insanity already beginning to return.
Already. One day I went to Washington to present some evidence to the government bureau. I had been out of town before doing this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Okay, he's sane now. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased, and you, my partners, would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Man, Fred was sailing that night. Man, that guy really didn't have a problem in the world. Now, let me show you what happened here. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. Now we got the squiggly right. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. Now, for a man that just got out of the hospital from drinking, to think it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner, that is insanity. All the cocktail in my meal, now the craving takes over. I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. Then I returned to the hotel. It struck me a highball would be fine to go into bed, so I stepped in the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know a little of where I went, what I said and did. Then came the hospital and the unbearable mental and physical suffering.
Jim's willpower tried to work. You know, Jim's willpower, he vaguely sensed he wasn't being any too smart. But Fred's willpower was non-existent because his mind saw absolutely nothing wrong with taking the drink. Just a couple cocktails with dinner would be good. And his mind didn't even vaguely sense that wasn't being any too smart, so he ordered them, took a drink, triggered the allergy, and then started the rat race over again. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come that I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, yes, that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in these strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then, and it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much, and asked me if I thought myself alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions.
They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Bottom of page 43. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And as I read and study this chapter, I begin to realize it really doesn't make much difference whether I like the idea of a spiritual experience or not. If I want to live, apparently I'm going to have one because of the insanity of alcoholism. And I begin to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that's very difficult for me to believe because I find that through my lifetime, I have really been what we would refer to as an agnostic. We got 30 minutes. We got to go. We got to have a consultation. Excuse us. 10:30. Of what I had been, that God really would probably not want anything to do with me at all. I felt because of what I had been that he certainly would not relieve my alcoholism. And I find that all my life I've had difficulty in receiving help from any power greater than I was. At one time I thought maybe I was an agnostic. I mean an atheist. Then for a time I would think I was an agnostic. And finally, I began to recognize the fact that it doesn't make any difference what I thought I was. Some way, I'm going to have to change and get from that stage of the game over to one who is able to receive God's power in his life. And today, we kind of look at this thing and we see that there's really only about three ways that we human beings can believe in a power greater than we are. You know, we have some people who say they are atheists. And an atheist is one who says that God does not exist. In fact, he professes to be able to prove that he does not exist. And in his mind, if God doesn't exist, then there's no power greater than he is to help him out. He says that the mind of the human being is the ultimate power and ultimate knowledge. And therefore, the human being must stand on his own two feet, make his own decisions, and rule his own destiny, because there's no other power to help him. But the agnostic is different. The agnostic believes that God exists, but he acts as if he doesn't exist. All my life I've believed in God. You know, I was taught that as a child growing up, and I've always believed that God exists. But I've always acted as if he did not exist. I've always done the same thing that the atheist did. I've always tried to stand on my own two feet, make my own decisions, and rule my own destiny. And the only difference between me and the atheist is that he disbelieved and I believed, that we both acted the same way. The third way that we can believe in God is to believe that he exists and act as if he exists. And don't stand on our own two feet. Turn to him for direction and receive the strength and the power from him and not try to rule our own destiny. Let it be ruled by a power greater than we are. And we've seen true believers all of our lives. We've seen people that were able to do that. And they had reasonably happy and reasonably peaceful lives and got along pretty good. Some great trauma come about in their life and they seem to be able to rise above it and live over it.
because they not only believed God existed, but they had a process by which they could get the aid of the power greater than themselves. So today we're really faced with one of these three ideas. Each of us, we're either an agnostic, we're an atheist, or we're a true believer. And this chapter is going to be designed to show me how I can get from the atheistic state or the agnostic state over to the state of the true believer. A very simple procedure that I can follow to let this thing begin to take place. Later on, I'm going to be called upon to make a decision between this powerlessness and this power. And without this chapter, we agnostics, I doubt if I could ever have made that decision because of the things I thought and the way that I believed in the past. Tells me on page 44 that in the preceding chapters you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
Okay, now, at this point, we see the simplicity of the book and its clarity at that time. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If one of you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And here we've seen the great simplicity of the first 100 people. Now that, right here they have two questions to determine if you're an alcoholic. This was before they wrote the 44 questions and complicated the hell out of it. You don't need but two questions determining if you're an alcoholic. And Charlie and I, we see what we have done to AA. We've made it so much better, we can't hardly understand it. John and I, we said we're sure glad that Ebbie didn't have the 44 questions when he went to see Bill that day. I can just see him standing up there reading them 44 questions off and Bill drinking that gin. And he's saying, is drinking hurting your reputation? Bill hadn't had no reputation for years. Is alcohol interfering with your sex life? he just has two questions. It's two questions. If when honest you want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. And if when drinking you cannot control the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. It's just that simple. To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience, if you're an atheist or agnostic, it seems impossible. A spiritual experience would seem impossible for an atheist or agnostic. But continue as he is means disaster. Especially as an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, to be doomed to an alcoholic death,
step one,
or to live on a spiritual basis,
step two,
are not always the easiest alternatives to face.
So he keeps throwing those two facts at us over and over and over.
Establishing steps one and two.
But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up, something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. Whatever your belief is, it really doesn't make any difference. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would recover it long ago. And many of us would have. Many of us had good morals. Many of us had a good philosophy of life. But we didn't seem to be able to live up to them. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. And we believe that this is one of the major differences between the alcoholic and a drunken bum. A drunken bum really doesn't care where he is to any great extent. He's right where, kind of doing what he wants to do. But an alcoholic wants to be something different. And he may be there with a drunken bum, but he doesn't want to be there. He has a better code of morals, a better philosophy of life, and he really doesn't want to live that way. But he finds that he absolutely simply cannot live that way. He just does not have the power to be better than what he's been doing. And the book says, lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. It had to be a power greater than we are, because we tried to solve it, and we couldn't do it. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And if you carefully read that, now it doesn't say its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will help you solve your problem, or which will enable you to solve your problem. It says, which will solve your problem. And as soon as I read that, it opened up an entirely new ballgame. Because up to this point, I've been looking at sobriety as the end-all, be-all of everything. And it doesn't say that the purpose of the book is sobriety. It says the purpose of the book is to find the power. And if I find the power, then the power will automatically solve the problem and take care of the sobriety. And you know, from this point on, we're through talking about alcohol. From this point on, the book talks about one thing only. How do you find this power? How do you get from the powerless state of the atheist or agnostic to the state of the true believer, one who has found the power and can actually use that power in their life? And then that power will take over for them. And after the reading of this, I think we'll all be able to see, well, gosh, this thing really isn't as bad as what we've been thinking it is. We go over to page 47. And on page 47, it begins to tell us the procedure that we follow to find this power greater than we are.
Okay, the middle paragraph of the book, he gets right down to the point. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Now, how do we find this power? And he says, we believe or become willing to believe. And I think that this, we're going to find that this is why our program is so simple and why it actually deals with the basic successes of life. The basis, the way that we people proceed to do anything. Not only accomplish this, but any task in our lives, it's all based on what we believe. Believing is the beginning of accomplishing any task. And it's a force that each and every one of us have in our minds. You know, it's this individual thing. It's a power that we have. Our lives are not based on our ability or on faith. It's based on whatever we believe. Whatever we believe, we can achieve. And this is the basic way we as humans proceed in any task. The first thing we do is to believe. Now, after we believe, like I say, if I want to pick up this ashtray, I have to believe I can pick it up. Because if I don't believe I'm going to pick it up, I'm not going to even try. Now, once we believe, then the next thing to do is the believing is no good in itself. It's a domino theory. Once we believe we can do something, then we have to, next, believing becomes strong enough to produce a decision. The believing produces a decision. Now, the decision itself is not, it doesn't do the job either. The decision is no good unless the decision produces action. We have to act out the decision. Now, we get results from the action. And once we get, once we believe we can do something, we decide to do it, we act out and we get good results from the actions. Now, once we get good results, then we no longer believe. Once we get good results, then we know. And that's faith. But we have to start believing. Believing is the beginning. As soon as we believe, we're on our way. Now, we're going to see that this is a basic way that we'll accomplish any task in our life. And this is the way our steps in our program is laid out on the basic formulas of success. Step 2 is believe. Step 3 is decision. Step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is the action. Then we have the promises. And step 12 says, having had, we know. Then one who knows. The one who knows can help the new person come to believe. All we have to do to start is to believe. Believing is the foundation for success. Whatever we believe, we become. Now that is a, if you believe something, whatever we believe, what I am today is a result of something I believed in the past.
Now remember that the atheist does not believe.
That's right.
Well, he can't. The agnostic believes, but he acts as if he does not believe.
Yeah.
So therefore, the agnostic can get no more than the atheist
right.
can. Okay. And the book says, all I need to do is believe, or
become.
For the atheist to become willing to believe. Now, even the atheist will agree that there's such a thing as evolution. And if evolution isn't guided by some force greater than human power, we don't know what is. Even the atheist recognizes that something keeps the earth revolving and makes light and dark. And even the atheist will recognize some power grows trees. So is he willing to believe in a power greater than human power? Not necessarily a specific power, but a power greater than human power. And that's all we have to do, is to believe or to be willing to believe. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. He's beginning to paint a picture for us again, and later on he'll refer to this spiritual structure. Once before he talked about belief back in his story when he talked about believing being the foundation. And now he says it's going to be the cornerstone. And based upon that belief, we're going to build a spiritual structure. And we'll see what it is later on. And he said, oh, that was great news to us.
Hmm?
5 minutes? Yeah. Oh, till we run out
yeah.
of tape.
Yeah.
That was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. So faith comes after. Faith is the result of. Faith is knowledge. Belief is upfront information. And it only has to be just enough to lead us to suspicion. And how can we not, when we come in AA, begin to believe? We hear literally hundreds of people say, but by the grace of God, I haven't felt necessary to drink for X number of days, months, or years. Because there's a power greater than I am, I don't have to drink alcohol. We've got to become a little bit suspicious that there must be something going on in this thing. And that's really all we need in order to start. You notice the little asterisk again? And you go down at the bottom of the page and it says, please be sure to read Appendix 2 on spiritual experience. Just begging us to read that, see? Letting us know that this really isn't some great religious thing, that this is just a way to get from a state of disbelief over to a state of being a true believer. And it gives us some examples now, one or two examples on how to do that.
Okay.
Very simple procedure.
Go to page 51. He never tells us about it until he comes and gives us the examples, some vivid examples of how to use this. We've seen people all through our lives accomplish tasks, and they come off the bottom and they succeed in life. We read about them every day in a paper through believing that they can accomplish a task in business or sports or something. This world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than all the millenniums which went before. Now, if we let these things unfold, we'll say that in our lifetime, in the last 100 years,
go ahead, John. Go ahead.
The last 100 years, we have made more material progress, that is, inventions, as the things that we have discovered in our life. We think about the travel, air travel, airplanes, all the new energies and everything else that we have discovered. Most of this has been discovered in the last 100 years.
But he can put us on another table.
Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of the men in those days was equal to the best of today. Now, even though in our time we have discovered all these things in the last 100 years, probably most of them, you know, most of the modern things, the things that we use today in our lives, most of these things were degenerated in the last 100 years. Now, the men of ancient times, we think that we are more intelligent than those people since the beginning of time. Now, this is not true. Those people had the same minds, the same intellectual minds that we have, yet they didn't discover a thing. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry and research and invention was almost unknown. Now, and in the realm of materials, men were fettered by superstition, traditions, and all sort of fixed ideas. Although, you know, men of the past had the same minds that we did. We did, but they did not use their minds. Now, we have to look at the society they lived in at this time. You know, if you were in medieval times and you thought about something that was different, if you come up something with different, some new idea, you better keep it to yourself. Because if you dared to believe different than anybody else, they would call you a witch or some kind of way out thing, and they would actually punish you for believing different. They did not allow you to believe different. They held that in, and therefore these people had intelligence, but they couldn't use it because of the world that they lived in at this time. Now, therefore, they discovered nothing. They went along with the same old stuff. And nobody dared to talk about anything new.
Stop right there.
And remember, in Columbus days, in Columbus's time, everybody believed in a lie. The whole world believed the world was square. And they believed if you sailed so far, you would far off, go off the edge. And we know Columbus was an alcoholic. Now, see, no one but an alcoholic can believe against the whole world. Right? See, you got to be hard-headed and self-centered, because Columbus was the only one that said, I believe it's round. Everybody else said it was square. And now, that is also a great example, because the only way you can change is to believe different. If you become what you believe, if you want to change, you got to believe different. You can't believe the same and change. And Columbus was big enough and strong enough to believe different against the whole world. And we say we knew he was an alcoholic because when he left, he didn't know where he was going. That's a drunk. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he didn't know where he'd been. And ain't nobody would go east by sailing west but a drunk. Well, we really made him an alcoholic. It was a woman financed the whole trip. Okay. And Charlie and I, we laugh about it. See, Columbus believed the world was round. He really did. But Charlie and I suspect that the first night, two nights out, he had a guy on the front of the boat said and told him, he said, if you see the edge of this damn thing, you holler out, you know.
Now let's see what Columbus actually accomplished on believing. Everybody else said the world is flat. And Columbus said, I believe it's round. But that really didn't do him any good because he was still standing on the seashore when he said that. And he kept looking out there across the ocean and believing that the world was round. One day he said, I'm going to go find out about this mess. And he made a decision to sail out there and see whether it was or not. But that didn't do him any good either because he was still standing on the seashore when he made the decision. Now he had to take some action. He had to have some ships, he had to have some crews, he had to have provisions, and he had no money. So he had to go somewhere and get the money. So he went to the king of Portugal first. And the king said, man, you crazy as hell. There ain't no way I'll invest money in one of those kind of schemes. That's when he went to the queen of Spain. And he conned her into letting him have the money to go, on the promise that he would bring her back shiploads of gold and spices and etc. from the East Indies. And she let him have the money, and he bought the ships, hired the crews, and put in the provisions. And then they sailed across the ocean, took action. As the result of that action, he found out the world really isn't flat. You don't sail off the edge of it, because he run into some land over there, and he thought it was India is where he was going, and he named it the East Indies. Turned out that it wasn't that at all, but he thought it was. He turned around, he came back home. And he went to the Queen of Spain, and she said, Columbus, where's my gold? And he said, I didn't find any, honey. But he said, if you'll give me some more money, I'll go back, and this time I'll find it. And she refinanced him, and he took the same trip over again, with one great difference. When he went the first time, he went on belief. When he went the second time, he went on knowledge. He did not put anybody on the front of the ship saying, if you see the edge of this sucker, holler out. Because he knew now that he wouldn't sail off the edge of it. So you see, there's a difference between belief and faith. And I always thought you had to have faith in order to receive the help of the power. Therefore, I could not receive it. Now, the book's saying, man, you ain't got to know nothing. You just got to believe. And you can start from that belief. It even talks about the Wright brothers. It says even in our present century, you know, people displayed belief. American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. People did not believe that man could fly a powered aircraft. The best mathematical minds in the world had proven that a powered aircraft could not fly. People said that was reserved for the birds. Yet the Wright brothers didn't believe that. You know, and it blows my mind today to think about the Wright brothers. They were not great engineers or great mathematical minds. They were both high school dropouts. They were bicycle mechanics. I don't know how in the world they ever believed that they could build a damn powered aircraft, but they did. And they built one, and they tried to fly it, and it crashed. And I can just see Orville telling Wilbur, said, Orville, you, he says, Wilbur, you nut, I told you this damn thing wouldn't work to start with, you know. And Wilbur says, well, let's take it back and fix it and modify it and try it again. And after a while, it flew. And somebody called this American newspaper man and said, hey, put out across the wire services that the Wright brothers had a successful flight at Kitty Hawk. And the guy said, man, you crazy as hell. He said, if I put that out over the wire services, they'll fire me for telling a lie like that. That's in our present century we didn't believe that. See? But look at what happened in the realm of flight based upon the Wright brothers' simple belief that they could build an airplane that would fly. They believed, they decided, they acted, and they got results. And my book tells me this is a very simple procedure. Page 52. You know, even today, the best mathematical minds in the world today have proven that a bumblebee can't fly. Now, based upon his size and his weight and his wing, mathematics will prove to you today that the bumblebee absolutely cannot fly. The only thing wrong with that theory is that the bumblebee can't read. He believes that he can fly. And he does it every day, based upon his belief. Middle of page 52, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. We've changed our point of view in the realm of the material. And because of that, we've seen the automobiles, we've seen airplanes, we've seen microwaves, we throw old gadgets out, bring new ones in. Our ideas change every day in the realm of the material. And we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change your point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their problems by simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. The Wright brothers' almost childish faith, and that's what belief is, that they could build a machine which would fly was the mainspring of their accomplishment there. Without that, nothing could have happened. So my book is telling me that I got to find a power greater than I am that will solve my problem for me. It's giving me a simple procedure to find that power, and now it's going to give me one more great thing. And after that, I'll be able to make a decision. And the other great thing it'll give me is on page 55. And it will tell me where to find the power. I've got to find it. It tells me how to find it. Now it tells me where it is. In all my life, I've looked for God. As a kid growing up, I had an idea that he was a tall, elderly gentleman. I always could see him on a cloud, I thought. And he had long, flowing white hair. And he had a golden halo around his head, and sun rays came out from that. And I looked, and I looked, and I looked. I never could see him. I looked for him in the birds. I looked for him in the bees. I looked for him in the trees. And I never could really find him. And I think the reason I couldn't is because I always looked in the wrong place. On page 55, it said, "Yet we'd been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found, and it was so with us." Now I tie that back with a spiritual experience, which said when we become aware of the fact that we have tapped an unsuspected inner resource of strength that we presently identify with a power greater than ourselves, then we will know We've had a spiritual experience. And my book is telling me the only place I'm going to find God's within myself. But the great reality is that He dwells deeply within all human beings. And we believe today that every human being, deep down inside, has some form of intelligence. And we can call it innate knowledge, or we could call it common sense, or we could call it the conscience, or we could call it the soul, or we could call it anything we want to. But it seems as though deep down inside of us, there is a basic knowledge of how to live. And the only thing we have to do is to be able to let that knowledge come to the surface. We've never been able to do that before because it's been obscured by pomp, by calamity, by worship of other things such as money, power, and prestige. Now, if this is true, then that means God dwells within me. And it means also He dwells within you. And if He dwells within us as individuals, then by golly, we can have our own personal God. I don't have to worry anymore whether it's the God of the Catholic Church, the Baptist Church, the Protestant religion, the Jewish religion, or whatever it is. Because each of us can have our own personal God. And I get along just great with mine. You know. Yeah, mine's old John or old Jack, and we just have a hell of a time together. And when we become aware of the fact that it's there, and we've tapped it, and because of that, we've received a strength that has helped us to overcome our disease, then we will know also that we've undergone this spiritual experience that the Big Book talks about. Great to know that God dwells within each of us, and that we can use the power. It's there. All we got to do is open it up and reveal it and let it come to the surface. People keep saying in AA, you got to get this, you got to get that, you got to find God. Hell, God ain't lost. You know? God's been here since the beginning of time. And if you've been here that long, it's pretty hard to get lost. The only thing we got to do is get rid of, so God can come to the surface. And everything that we do from here on will be to eliminate, to get rid of, so the good thing that we already have can come to the surface. I didn't know that before I read the chapter, We Agnostics. Isn't that something? Joe? Stu? Mm-hmm. Let's quit for the night. Stu?